funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
We enjoy unprecedented sexual freedom in the 21st century. So why is sex still such a source of anxiety? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. A couple of generations ago, our culture sent the message that sex was, by definition, dirty and often morally suspect. There was something wrong with people who wanted it too much. Today, in this post-sexual revolution era, we understand that an interest in sex is natural and healthy. But the flip side of the idea that it's normal to engage in sex is the idea that those who aren't having sex are somehow abnormal and can't possibly live a full and well-adjusted life. That perception plays into what my guest calls the sex myth. Rachel Hills has written for The Atlantic, New York Magazine, and Vogue, and she's the author of a blog called Musings of an Inappropriate Woman. Her new book is The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. Rachel, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
By the way, as you no doubt gathered from this introduction, today's show is about human sexuality. We don't expect the discussion to get graphic, but if you're listening with children and don't feel like having the talk right at this very moment, now is probably the time to find something else to keep them busy for a little while. Okay, Rachel, you write about the fact that you were consumed by the idea of sex in your late teens and early 20s, which is not the same as obsessively pursuing sex itself.
That's right. So I started working on the book about 8 years ago now when I was 25. And the initial impetus to start working on it came from a lot of the feelings that I was having in my early 20s. So at that point in my life, I wasn't having sex at all, which was partly something I chose, but certainly wasn't my ideal situation. I would have preferred to have been sexually active if a good option had been available. And I felt very alone and kind of defective in that, because it's so different to the script or the story that we expect to play out for, you know, progressive, liberated, quote-unquote, young women today.
And I want to be clear, and I hope this doesn't offend you that I point this out. You pointed out in the book, there's nothing unusual about you. Your appearance is normal. there's no reason why you couldn't find a partner. You just wanted to find someone you were committed to.
Yeah, I wanted to find somebody who I really liked and who liked me. And it turns out that that's actually difficult for quite a lot of people, whether they're women, men, straight or gay, and quite regardless of how they look as well.
Where did you look to understand what was normal and where you fit on the continuum of a normal sex life for a young woman in her 20s?
Do you mean at the beginning or when I started researching the book? I think I got a lot of my cues from popular culture and not necessarily from specific sources, although I do make a joke on the first page of the book about how I read Cosmo every month to try to figure out how I would have sex if the occasion were to arise. But I think that it kind of came from everything around me. So the dramas that I'd watch on television, sitcoms, the aforementioned magazines, the movies, the conversations you have with your friends and even with your family, which all communicate the same kind of unspoken assumption that to be sexually active, and to be sexually active in quite particular specific ways we can get into later, which is, I guess, primarily heterosexual kind of penetrative sex, there's an assumption that to be sexually active and to do it in this way is the default. And we assume that that's the case, and we don't even imagine that it could be otherwise unless it's stated directly.
I want to listen to a cut from the HBO show Girls. This is the characters of Hannah and Shoshana. Lena Dunham and Zosia Mamet are the actresses talking about a TV show that they're watching.
Do you know where Jess is? Do you know when she'll be home?
Probably not till late. She has a job now.
Okay, I guess everybody has a job now.
Oh, my effing G, no.
What are you watching?
Baggage.
Baggage? What's Baggage?
It's like my favorite show on Game Show Network.
Oh, Marnie and I don't have cable, so I haven't seen that.
Shut up. No way. Get over here now. Okay, so there are three contestants. Today they're girls, and this guy Danny is looking for love, and they each have three suitcases, a little one, a medium one, and a big one. And then they have, like, their secret baggage, and they reveal it, and if it's super freaky, he eliminates them. Okay, like this chick, her littlest baggage is that she spends $1,000 a month on her weave, which host Jerry Springer thinks is unbelievable. Her medium baggage is that she plans her wedding after the first date, and her biggest baggage is that she pokes holes in condoms.
Whoa! That's a crazy thing to do.
I know. What would you put in your baggage?
I don't know. I feel like...
So, like, for me, I think that my littlest baggage would probably be my IBS. And my medium baggage would be that I truly don't love my grandmother.
Like, you don't love her at all?
Mm-mm.
So then what would your biggest baggage be?
That I'm a virgin. Obviously.
That's the television show Girls. So, Rachel, the Shoshana character's biggest baggage is being a virgin as a 20-something, early 20-something unmarried woman. This is like exactly the opposite of what our culture expected of women a couple of generations ago. What assumptions do we make about adults who are not sexually active?
Well, I think the assumptions we make about adults who aren't sexually active are, in some respects, kind of the inverse of what we expect or associate with people who are. So we live in a culture where to be sexually active is associated with being desirable, not just in the sense of being physically attractive, but in the sense that people want to be around you, and sex is seen as being an expression of that. It's also an expression of it's an expression of the strength of your relationship. It's considered an expression of health as well. And so adults who, and it's also, I think, quite importantly, and this connects to the adult point, it's considered a rite of passage. So the first time that you have sex, particularly for people who do it when they're teenagers, not so much for people who are 20-somethings like me or Shoshana, but it's considered this rite of passage where you go from being a child to being an adult. And so conversely, adults who are not sexually active, and in particular adults who have never been sexually active, then I guess portrayed as, or they may feel undesirable, or they may be portrayed as people who aren't, you know, living life to the fullest or fully engaged with life, or people who perhaps aren't in touch with their own desires. Even though what I found, both through the kind of sociological and theory-based research that I did and through the hundreds of interviews that I did as well, is that to not be sexually active, whether that's ever or just at a particular point in your life, that's often, in fact, is usually more circumstantial than it is a reflection of your kind of deepest being and status.
How did we get to a place where sex went from something you do to something that is central to your identity?
Well, I think we've kind of been in that place for a long time. So as we've discussed, the title of my book is The Sex Myth. And it's not so much about sex myths in the plural, but it's about the kind of huge symbolic mystique that we attach to sexuality. And in Western culture, that's a mystique that has very deep roots. It goes back thousands of years, and I trace it back a few hundred years in the space of my book. So I'm not sure that sex was ever just something that you do. It was always an act that was considered to have profound consequences. But I think that this idea that that at least now one of the wrong ways to be sexual is to not be having sex, in addition to being considered to have it in the wrong way, I think it's kind of an unintentional or an unintended consequence or unintended reaction to the previous idea, which was, as you discussed at the beginning, that to be having sex or to be having the wrong kind of sex makes you dirty. And obviously that's an idea that's harmful to many people. It has been historically, particularly to women and queer people, and it continues to be today. But I think there can be a tendency to say, well, if saying that sex is bad hurts people, then accordingly talking about how wonderful sex is and how central it is to your health and to your life and to your relationships must be good. But then that creates a whole set of additional and alternative expectations.
There's this phrase that people throw around, better than sex, which is to say impossibly good. Like, it couldn't possibly be better than sex, but people use this as a way to describe something. And you leave open the possibility that there are, in the course of a human existence, some things that may be better than sex on occasion.
I think so. I think even in the course of a day, there may be things that are better than sex on occasion. I think that idea of better than sex is really central to the mystique or the mythology that surrounds sexuality in our culture. This idea that nothing could possibly be better or more pleasurable than sex. When the reality is that actually the vast majority of us, I'd say even all of us, make choices on a day-to-day basis to do things that aren't sex. And sometimes they may be things that we actually don't want to do, so it's not really a choice. So you might be doing housework or you might be going to your job that you hate. But there are many occasions where we may choose to watch a good TV show or even a bad TV show instead of having sex, or where we choose to hang out with a friend or go to a party or go hiking or do many other things. And that's not to say that sex isn't also good. It can be absolutely fantastic. It's to say that there are other things in our life that also bring us great pleasure.
Wrapped up in the sex myth are a number of misconceptions about what everybody else is doing, right? And about the role sex plays in modern life. We'll talk about those. But first, I'd like you to get into how researchers gathering data about behavior, and this would include you for this book, try to ascertain whether their interview subjects are telling them the truth.
That's a good question. I do tend to be quite trusting to a degree, because I feel like if somebody gets in touch with you and wants to talk to you about their sex life, they're not going to be sitting down in front of you and outright lying, generally speaking. And if they are, there's kind of a different kind of social dynamic where you can identify it in the same way that you can tell if someone's having you on in any other kind of engagement. It's, I guess, kind of a basic kind of interviewer skill. But something I did find while doing my interviews, and in particular, because I did most of them in 2012 and the years that followed, is that while people I spoke to may not have lied directly, they would sometimes later admit to me that there were things that they withheld, or that there were things that they were terrified that I would ask them, and then were relieved when I did not ask them about that directly, so that they didn't have to lie.
Why is it so hard to talk about sex?
I think, again, it goes back to this myth or mystique that surrounds sex. It's this idea that what we do when it comes to sex says something very important about who we are, that it defines our desirability, our morality, how interesting a person we are, how well our relationship is going. And that means that when our experiences with sex deviate from the story that we've been told is expected of us in any way, and for almost everybody, it deviates in at least one way, that creates an enormous kind of emotional burden. There's this fear that you'll be found out.
So if you say one wrong thing that causes people to think you are peculiar in some way, they will brand you for life as a very weird person.
I think that's the fear, and it's a fear that some of the people that I interviewed did talk about in their interviews as well, because I think there's also an appeal, and my interviews were all qualitative, so I wasn't about finding out statistics and numbers, but about finding out what people were thinking and feeling. I think for a lot of the people who got in touch with me, there was an appeal of being able to talk to a stranger about it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like a free therapy session, if you will.
It was interesting that you spoke to some young heterosexual men who said sometimes they didn't feel like having sex with a date, but they felt like the expectation was that if they had the opportunity, they would try.
Yes, which was very interesting. And I think that partly comes down to expectations around men and masculinity and this cultural stereotype we have that men always want sex. And that was something that impacted women who were in heterosexual relationships as well. But I think it also comes down to, again, the sex myth itself. So if you, as some of these young men were, if you're out going out for drinking or to socialize with friends, and particularly when you're in that late teens, early 20s age group, often those kinds of engagements, whether you're a man or a woman or gay or straight or whatever, it is framed around this possibility that you might pick up, you might meet someone that you will want to hook up with or go home with. And so I think that for a couple of the guys that I interviewed who were going out on those occasions, and you know, the actual fact of taking someone home is quite rare. So you feel like you've hit the jackpot.
Don't let this one go. All right, let me jump
in
here.
Don't let this one go.
We have to take a quick break. My guest is journalist and blogger Rachel Hills. Her new book is called The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist and blogger Rachel Hills. Her new book is called The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. As you mentioned before, Rachel, the media tend to portray a fairly narrow spectrum of what sexuality should be, or they turn it on its head, as in a show like Sex and the City, in which the suggestion was that really cosmopolitan women approach sex with an intensity similar to that which we've expected in the past only from men.
Yes, that's right. And Sex and the City is particularly interesting as well, because even though it was quite groundbreaking at the time, and it certainly covered a lot of different sex acts, it was also very kind of normative in its own way. Not just in the sense that all of the main characters end the series in relationships, but also in the sense that when characters were kinky or even there was, I think, a bisexual man that Carrie dated, these characters were kind of treated like freaks as well.
Hmm. On the other hand, there is a sense these days that people whose sex lives are too normal, even if they're having sex, but they're not adventurous in some way, there's a sense that they're missing out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of become a double standard all of its own. So in the kind of media that does offer advice or guidance when it comes to sex, particularly kind of mass media in that area, on the one hand, you're told if you need to make your sex life interesting in order to maintain your relationship with your partner, and that's whether you're a man or a woman, even though I think historically that may have been more of a woman thing. But you also need it to self-actualized, kind of be the best version of yourself alongside having a great job and a great wardrobe. But then on the other hand, there are also these kind of warnings attached to engaging in, I guess, what people would have traditionally considered to be non-normative sexual activities. So in some of the magazines that I read while I was researching the book, very tough work, as you can imagine. There would be readers who would tell stories about the time I hooked up with a girl and then realized I definitely wasn't a lesbian, or the time I decided to explore my fantasy by taking my clothes off at a strip club and then my boyfriend broke up with me the next day, or the time I decided to explore kink or BDSM and then my partner thought I was really weird and our relationship ended. So it's interesting that on the one hand, you're meant to try these things, but they're meant to be these kinds of additions rather than, you know, the main focus of your sex life.
Before you actually worked at Cosmo, wrote for Cosmo about sex, what did you imagine the staff there would be like?
Well, my work for Cosmo has been entirely as a freelancer, mm-hmm. and I've worked both at the magazine and at the website in a freelance capacity, and I haven't spent a huge amount of time in the office, but I guess, because before I was writing for it, I was very young, so I was really a teenager at the time. I think when I was reading those magazines and kind of seeing them as the guidance of how I would find out how to pick up and how to make sure I engaged in sex properly when I had it, I think I probably saw the writers as being experts in the area, which then when I started to write my earliest women's mag articles, even before doing the book, I realized that this was probably definitely not the case, that at best the writers were people like me and they didn't know exactly the right formula to get a great relationships or sex life either.
Were you in the closet about your virginity when you first started writing about sex?
Well, I started out as a journalist writing more about feminism. Mm-hmm. And obviously feminism and sex are areas that do intertwine a bit. If you write about one, sometimes you'll write about the other, and suddenly debates around sex are big in feminism. But I remember shortly before I started working on the book, I was maybe 24. 24 at the time, there was a women's magazine in Australia that I was writing for that approached me asking me if I wanted to write an article on virginity or adult virginity. And I was absolutely thrilled at the time because I absolutely did want to write an article on virginity and the stigma associated with it, or the very complicated stories that were being told about it at the time, because this was also shortly after Britney Spears and Jessica Simpson were all talking about their virginity, because they're about my age. So I was delighted that I got to write about it, but I'm also 99.9% certain that the editor didn't know I was a virgin. She just asked me to do it for her because I did lots of her social analysis style pieces.
A few years ago, we saw, I guess, the apex of the Girls Gone Wild phenomenon. And the takeaway for many people was that young women had never been more sexually promiscuous, sexually adventurous than they were now. This wasn't something that you were observing in everyday life, even among your peers who were sexually active.
Absolutely. And I mean, those words are so loaded, aren't they? Particularly promiscuous. Mm-hmm. This idea, young women have never been more promiscuous than they have ever been before. Even if it were the case that young women were having more sex than they ever were before and they were really enjoying it, the word promiscuous is so negative. So I think that whole debate around hookup culture and Girls Gone Wild, it was itself this kind of double-edged sword. So in 2007 in the United States, there were nearly 1,000 articles published about hookup culture that year. So it was this kind of cultural obsession. And this was around the same time I started writing the book. And of course, most of these stories, they were moral panic stories. They were designed to get people very worried about what young people were doing. But at the same time, even though they were saying this is bad, they're also saying this is normal. And meanwhile, here I was at the time, 24 or 25, and I had a really good social life at the time and was meeting lots of interesting people, whether friends or prospective dating partners, and going out a lot. And really quite belatedly, sadly, I realized that despite that story about everybody picking up when they go to the club, this is more a rarity than it was a commonplace activity.
What did you find out about the numbers of college students hookups? And we're talking about women and men here. We don't want to just focus this on young women.
Yeah, I think that's really important because women's sexuality is discussed so much more than men's is, which is because women's sexuality tends to be conceived as a problem so much more than men's is. So the best research that we have on college students and hooking up is from the Online College Social Life Survey, which is this massive survey of American college students. They didn't speak face-to-face with most of them, but they literally handed surveys online to 24,000 people. So it gives you a kind of really clear statistical picture of what's going on. And basically, they found that indeed people do hook up. Not everybody hooks up, but this idea of engaging in sexual activity, whether that's intercourse or something else, with someone who you're not in a relationship with, which is really the definition of hookup more than sex, that is quite commonplace amongst young people, as I think it is somewhat commonplace amongst all people in relationship, who are not in relationships these days. And so they found that 72% of college students had engaged in some kind of hookup at least once by their senior year. But the key thing here is that having hooked up, just as having had sex once doesn't mean you're having it all the time, having hooked up doesn't mean you're hooking up with somebody every week or even every month. So importantly, 40% of those surveyed also had hooked up with three or fewer people over the course of their college career. Now, that's not a measure of the number of people they've had sex with, because they could have had sex with people who were not hookups. Mm-hmm. And they also likely had hookups that were not what most people still define as being sex. But it does show both a cultural shift, I guess, in what's considered acceptable, but then the way that's played out in everyday life isn't the way that it plays out in the cultural imagination.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi, wonderful program. I thought I'd give you a perspective from an older person. I'm 72. I'm heterosexual. I've been married and divorced twice, and I've been single for 16 years. And I've dated a lot, and I've gathered almost like PhD in in romance and love and sex.
That's awesome.
A lot of case studies. And regarding your myth, I remember back in the 50s and 60s, early 60s, my role as a man a lot of times was like almost a protector, almost like a Don Quixote type. There was a Madonna sort of myth that you didn't have sex before marriage. Okay, rewind, in my second bachelorhood, there was a sexual riot in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and I felt like I had to be more like James Bond. Love him, leave him.
Yeah.
And then in in the wisdom of my later years, I'm now 72, women are looking more at me as sort of a trusted companion, a Marcus Welby or a Dr. Oz, to be with them and accompany them. And so what I've determined is that sex is something highly individualistic. You can't generalize about it. Everyone is so different, men and women. I have a good friend who's had a prostatectomy. He can't have sex at all. You know, and I've met other people that they want to have sex after 2 weeks. Let's get going.
Yeah, great perspectives. Thank you for your call, Bill. Anything there, Rachel, that you want to respond to?
I think Bill's absolutely right that the way that people experience sex is highly individual. And that part of the problem is, firstly, that even though we appear to talk about sex constantly as a culture, we don't really know what's going on in other people's sex lives. So it's surrounded by mystery. And then the story that we're told about what sex is or how it's supposed to be is quite monolithic in comparison. So a common story for people, I guess, of all age groups, but moving a bit beyond the young person age group that I focus on more in my book, is this idea that in a good relationship, sex is supposed to happen twice a week. And of course, in some relationships, it happens 4 or 5 times or more times a week. And in other relationships, it might happen once a month or less. And any kinds of both kinds of relationships and everything in between can be happy. But secondly, the idea, which also goes back to Bill's comment, that certain types of sex are more valid than others. So when we talk about doing it twice a week, what I think people are tending to be talking about is penetrative sex, whereas you could actually be sexual or sensual with another person or even with yourself in many, many other ways that go beyond that simple act. So the idea that you can define intimacy or define desirability purely through this one act of putting a penis into a vagina, I think is kind of faulty.
And you write that for some people, they hear this this number, you know, 2 times a week, and they're like, that better be my baseline or else there's going to be something wrong with my relationship.
Yes, I definitely heard that, more so from women that I interviewed than men, which is interesting given that another one of the cultural stories we tell about sex is that men desire sex constantly, and that's part of why people should be aspiring to do it regularly.
Do you feel like, or have you seen evidence that easy access to pornography has shaped assumptions about sex?
That wasn't really the focus of my research. I think the best way to look at pornography is really as a form of media, alongside all other forms of media. And pornography just happens to be a form of media that is highly concerned with sexuality. It's images of sex. And obviously, by definition, it's also images of sex that are designed to turn people on and get them off. And so as a form of media that is focused on sexuality, it's inevitably going to play a role in shaping people's perceptions of what good sex looks like, particularly on that kind of very physiological level or on a fantasy kind of level. But I think that this idea that that online pornography is a new technology is shaping and harming people's sexuality is probably overstated.
What do you think about your contemporaries who are professional sex writers, people who do columns online or in magazines or sort of purport themselves to be experts and answer the offer advice to people who call in with questions?
I guess it's funny because when you said my contemporaries who are sex writers, I'm like, I guess I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. For the previous year before the book came out, did a weekly column for Cosmopolitan Online where fortunately it wasn't about me offering advice, but I would interview people about various aspects of their sex life. And I think I learned as much from doing that as I learned through doing the research that led me to write the book. But in terms of people who proffer sex advice, I think it really depends on the person. So in my book, I do get a bit down on sexperts. I'm quite cynical of them, particularly because often, particularly in mainstream media, they'll put forward this idea that there's a particular way that sex is supposed to be. But then through doing my work and doing my journalism, I've met many wonderful sex educators who are all about trying to help people experience pleasure, but they're also about trying to create permission for people to experience sex or to not experience sex in whatever way is right for them. So they're kind of trying to fight that idea that there's one right way to do it.
It does seem that the openness we have to, sexual diversity today is a healthy thing, right? Most adults seem to believe that what takes place between other adults who are both consenting is not a problem. On the other hand, there is like this sense maybe that if that anyone who is not interested in sex is somehow damaged. There are, we've talked about people who would like to have sex but don't have a partner at the moment. You write about the phenomenon of being asexual, which is something that I don't know that I've read much about or that I have heard in many places, but it's a thing for some people who are made to feel pretty crazy.
So to be asexual is to be someone who does not experience sexual attraction to other people. So asexual people may masturbate or they may have sexual fantasies, but basically they have no interest in having sex with other people. And it's a phenomenon or it's a way of being that people weren't really talking about very much until the past 15 years when the internet allowed a whole bunch of people who'd been feeling this way for decades, depending on how long they'd been alive. But my point is there had been asexual people around, but there was no way for people to connect with each other and talk about it. And the way that people who are asexual are treated or discussed in our society is still, I guess it really runs to this root of the sex myth, this idea that if to be sexual is to be healthy and to be desirable and to be alive, then there are still a significant amount of people who think that asexual people must be in denial or that they must have awful lives, when really it's just another experience on the continuum of human sexuality.
Rachel Hills is my guest. She's a journalist and blogger with a new book out called The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Rachel Hills about her new book, The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. Join us at 800-933-5372. Rachel, in your interviews, did you find much of a relationship between people's religious beliefs or the extent to which they feel religious and their choices with regard to sex?
It wasn't specifically what I was studying, but on an observational level, one of the things that I found most interesting, and I think this is probably backed up by other people who've looked at this more specifically, I think there was a book that came out 5 or 10 years ago called Red Families, Blue Families, which looked at different family formations across the United States. So one thing I found was that it almost seemed to me that the more you were told don't have sex, the more likely you were to have an early sexual debut.
So, and word potentially to parents this, everywhere.
Yeah, whereas, you know, my parents said, well, they didn't say have sex whenever you want, but they were quite open and liberal, and then look what happened to me. So, but that was certainly true of many of the people that I interviewed, young, particularly amongst young women I spoke to. If they grew up in cultures where sex was surrounded by taboo and they were told, don't do it, it's bad, or it needs to be saved for marriage, often those women seem to be more likely to be having sex earlier in life, whereas the people who came from more liberal families seemed almost to be more likely to be virgins. Although, of course, there are people who do choose to take the path of abstinence till marriage as well.
You're Australian. You also mm-hmm. interviewed many Americans. I wonder how different the attitudes and ideas are about sexuality in different Western cultures.
Well, I think on the micro level, they weren't and as different as you would expect. So when I was speaking to individuals about what they wanted from their sex lives, or the kind of sex life that they felt that they should have, or how they felt about things, often the stories that I would hear would be very similar. But I think the main difference between Australia and the United States, or the United States and the UK, or the United States and Canada for that matter, is the way that sex is discussed on the macro level. So obviously sexuality is an incredibly fraught political issue here. Whether that's issues around same-sex marriage, which admittedly has been passed in this country, whereas in my home country, it's still a contentious issue that neither party will get behind. So you guys are a bit more progressive on that one than mine. But also, obviously, issues around reproductive rights and abortion, which are much, much more fraught here than they are elsewhere. And I think that that creates an environment where any kind of discussion of sex is far more politicized and far more kind of divided into two camps.
Have you been following the stories of the Ashley Madison hack?
A little. I think that happened just around the time my book came out, so I didn't have tons of time to read up on it. But I understand that they found a huge percentage of people were on that site, which seems almost unbelievable to me because it's very much out of line with surveys about the percentage of people who have affairs, which partly goes back to your earlier point about people lying in surveys, but perhaps also goes to the point that people can enroll on Ashley Madison and never at least have a physical affair.
And there were something like 37 million men and 12,000 women, so that might explain why lots of people were interested, but not so many mm-hmm. people had actual affairs.
Not so many opportunities, perhaps.
Right. I wonder if you think that the sex myth is something that has always existed in some form, even in the times when people didn't talk about sex at all, or if it's a product of modern culture where we feel like we can and should talk about sex, but we don't necessarily talk about every aspect of it.
I feel like it's something that has always existed, or has at least existed for a long time in some form. So the sex myth isn't a particular set of norms around sex. Obviously, because my book was published this year in 2015, the ideals and expectations that I focus on are primarily 21st century ideals. But this idea that the way that we have sex is something very important about who we are, our morality, our desirability, and our relationships is something that really goes back a long way. And it just kind of it changes shape according to the particular norms and expectations of any point in time, but it's kind of core power, which is this idea that the way that we engage in sex is really important, is something that I think has lasted for a long time.
As you pointed out earlier, the traditional assumption is that young men are always thinking about sex. Do they feel greater pressure than young women to sort of brag about their sexual exploits to their guy friends?
Yeah, it's something I kind of vacillate and go back and forth on, you know, who feels the most pressure. Maybe it's kind of like an oppression Olympics in some way. When I was writing the book, I felt that maybe young men felt more pressure. And now shortly before it came out, I kind of changed my mind and thought, well, maybe women felt more pressure because the women I spoke to seemed to be more self-regulating than the men. They were kind of monitoring themselves to make sure they were doing the right thing. But I think that I think women are still kind of stuck in this double bind where you're told do have sex, but also don't have it because that could make you a slut. But the difference for men is that they have almost a more cohesive message that they're being sent, which is this idea that your manhood is wrapped up in your ability to sleep with people. And I think because we still live in a society in which straightness is elevated over queerness, it's not just your masculinity is dependent on your ability to sleep with people. It's the idea that your masculinity is dependent on your ability to chase and sleep with women. And that means that men definitely suffer from that expectation, sometimes because it's not actually what they want to do. They don't want to be, I guess, playing the kind of Casanova game, or sometimes because it is what they want to do, but it's a very difficult standard to live up to, particularly when you have this fiction circulating that everybody is having sex every weekend or every month, and suddenly among single people, which most young people in particular are, that's not the case.
And is the old, well, I don't know that it's an old statistic, but I've heard that people who are in committed relationships are having more sex often than single people, despite the perception of people in committed relationships.
I think that is true simply because people in relationships have far more opportunity. I think that as relationships go on over time, often the frequency of sex declines. And when I say I think, what I mean is I've read studies that show that. But often people who are single, and if particularly if they're single in the truest sense, as in not really actively dating or in a relationship, they'll often go through very long times of not having sex. And that's partly the reason that I was celibate for such a long time. It was my main requirement is really that I wanted to be in a relationship, but I wasn't, so I didn't have sex. And even now that I'm in my 30s, I have friends who have never been in relationships, who are really wonderful people in every way, but sometimes it just doesn't happen for people. Although those friends have also had sex. So one of my friends joked to me last year that if she'd decided to wait till she met someone she loved, she would still be waiting.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have John on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hello. At 65 now, when I look back on my youth, I think I had a fairly normal, tortured male outlook on sex. But now that I'm 65, you know, nature takes its course, and I find my sex drive is diminished, and I live by myself, and I'm quite content, and I'm quite accepting of my sexual drive or lack thereof, and it could change, but I think men need to understand that it is not necessary to be sexually driven when you're older.
Thanks so much for your call, John. Anything you want to respond to, Rachel?
Also, thank you. And I'm really glad that you're comfortable with that. I think that's one of the benefits of getting older to some extent. And I even say that as someone in my early 30s, I'm certainly far more comfortable with myself now than I was when I started writing the book. And I think that's one of the benefits of growing older, that you grow comfortable with where you're at rather than necessarily feeling like you need to live up to these external ideals.
Yo, answer this question. Are you a virgin? Are you a virgin?
Yeah, not since I was 10.
It all makes sense. You're a virgin.
I am. Shut up.
How does that happen?
That, of course, is a cut from the movie The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And I play it, Rachel, because it does seem that the third rail in all this is the idea we can still accept the idea that a young woman could reach her mid-20s and wait for the right relationship. A lot of people think that a man who is even able to wait for that or has not found the right person, that there must be something terribly wrong with him.
Yeah, it's funny when you play these pop culture clips, it's kind of like flashbacks to my life 10 years ago. Kind of my worst nightmares of social engagements that could have happened but didn't. Yeah, I think that, I don't know, I'm not sure that there's more stigma for men around that than there is for women, but
really,
there absolutely is stigma for men around it. And probably my favorite person that I interviewed for the book, well, they're all my favorites, but this is, I think, one of the most interesting stories, was a young British man who came to be interviewed by me, and I was living in London at the time, and he caught the train in from a couple of hours away because that's how much he wanted to share his story. And then when we sat down, he was really nervous, and he was blushing and speaking really quietly so no one else in the room could hear him because we were in a cafe. And the reason that he was so embarrassed was that he was 23 and he was a virgin. And like I had, and like some other virgins I'd spoken to had as well, he felt really undesirable because of that. And he felt like his life wasn't unfolding the way that it was supposed to. He felt a lot of shame around it. And a couple of months after we did the interview, he got in touch again to say that he was embarrassed that he'd even spoken to me because he felt like speaking to me suggested that he felt like he had a right to have sex or that he would have sex someday. Mm-hmm. And from his perspective, he's like, well, obviously, if I got this far, it's never going to happen. But his story kind of has a light at the end of the tunnel because when I got in touch with him before I submitted the first draft of the book, I write about this in the book. And he told me that he'd had sex the night or the week before. And he'd realized that this thing that he'd built up in his mind as being kind of the worst thing about him wasn't actually that big a deal after all, that he was still the same person. And if having had sex made him fine, then maybe he was fine all along. Is that a bit too Hollywood? I don't know.
No, it's a nice story. And it just, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, to the extent that I'll generalize here, but I'll assume most people want to be having sex and they want it to be good. It seems like anxiety creeps in and really messes things up for people when it doesn't have to.
Yeah. And I think that is a product of the sex myth. It's a product of the idea that the way we engage in sex is something really important about us. And if you believe that your sex life defines your desirability or your relationship or whether you're a moral person or a deviant, that means that the decisions that you make when it comes to sex are grounded with this incredible emotional weight, which I believe is unnecessary, which is why I wrote the book.
I guess one good thing about the way we think about sex today and the way we assume that people are having it as often as they might choose to is that people who have sex with someone that turns out not to be a good person for them, they don't necessarily have to feel themselves tainted for the rest of their lives, at least in our culture. They can pick up and move on and not necessarily treat that as a source of great shame in their lives.
Absolutely. And I think that the culture that we have today is definitely more open than the culture that we had 50 or 60 years ago, based on the historical research that I've done. I guess my argument is not that we've gone too far. It's almost that we haven't gone far enough. We haven't created a society that is truly open, because a truly open society when it comes to sex would be one in which some forms of being sexual weren't considered better than others.
It's strange here that your subject matter is so provocative, and yet in some ways it's an argument for a broad and yet conservative interpretation of what it means to be healthily sexual.
Tell me more.
Well, I mean, weren't you worried that people would be surprised and shocked that you would say, for example, you know, that the better than sex thing wasn't necessarily always true?
I was definitely worried about that as I was writing it, because for me, as a feminist and as someone who identifies as being very liberal, the idea of somebody saying this is actually conservative would be quite upsetting to me. But maybe one of the most surprising things since the book has come out, I mean, obviously there have been a couple of people who have said that, but there have been far more people in the sex positive community who have come forward and said this is, if not exactly the kind of sexual freedom that I want to put forward, i.e. them, not me, then it's at least something close to it. So the amount of support I've had for this message has almost been a surprise.
The new book by journalist Rachel Hills is called The Sex Myth: The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. Rachel, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and the show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.